Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Labyrinths in the News for our first Monday episode of the new year, January 11th, 2010, of the Gregorian New Year, January 11th, 2010. I'm your host, Christiana, coming to you live from the Couve, that's Vancouver, Washington, across the river from Portland, Oregon, as I will be doing every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. My lead-in music is the first cut off of Susan Alexander's CD, Sequentia, called Ecos, which is short for icosahedron, the water symbol in sacred geometry. Sequentia is music using tones recorded from DNA vibrations. Susan recorded these tones in 1988 with the help of Dr. David Diemer, at that time a cell biologist at the Davis campus of the University of California. If any of you want to chat while we're on the air, please go to christiana-anea at blogtalkradio.com. My guest today is Sonam Tarji, an ethnomusicologist, herbologist, Ayurvedic, tantric, and yogic practitioner and teacher, and featured musician at the Labyrinth Society's 2008 gathering. Thank you, Sonam, for joining me today in the first episode of Labyrinths in the News for the Gregorian year 2010. Namaste.
Oh, I'm delighted to be joining you today. How wonderful.
Oh, you're on the East Coast, and yeah. And it's just about dinner time where you are, right, up in
yes,
New York?
We're in Rochester, New York, and so it's around 6:30, and the sun has gone down, and we're enjoying a nice, cool evening here.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of snow?
We do. We have a ton of snow, and more cold and snow than in the past few years, so skiers are delighted here.
Yes, I bet. Well, I've just been reading your... Now, please correct me. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yes, you have the name correctly. And just let me mention that the word Ayurvedic is the two words from the Sanskrit. Ayur means life, and Veda means science. So together, they're like the ancient Indian biology. And the correct pronunciation is Ayurveda.
Ayurveda. Ayurveda. I'm writing that down.
Beautiful.
I don't ever forget. reading your bio, Sonam, I was stunned, really. I'm overwhelmed by the depth of learning you've accomplished during your lifetime. You have a bachelor's in professional musicology. You play many world instruments. You have both a master's degree in neurology and one in Chinese medicine, as well as a practitioner's certificate in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, and plus you also have a wife and kids.
Right.
So that's just an amazing amount of accomplishment for one lifetime and everything that goes from that, the permutations of that. Can you tell us to begin with what enables you to create that the time you need to accomplish all of this that you've been doing and that you've done?
Oh, thank you. Well, I feel very much, you know, divinely guided, you might say. I feel open to divine inspiration from the time I was a little boy and I first started playing trumpet and felt like I'm being led in a way to serve sentient beings and to serve life here on the planet in ways that I couldn't have predicted, you know, when I was a kid. But just one thing kind of led to another, and like from classical music you move on to jazz, and from jazz it's an easy step to world music, and from Christianity in my early days, Christian teachings, it was an easy step to go to yoga and then to formal Hindu practice, and from there, Buddhism and Hinduism have much in common, so I have had Buddhist teachers and then Taoist teachers, and it was very much not, intentionally designed, but certainly feeling like I was given the energy to accomplish what I've been able to accomplish by just being present and staying sensitive to what the universe desired of me in that way.
Do you come from a long background of family musicians and people who have been playing the world music, the instruments, or this is something that you picked up yourself?
Well, my dad was a violinist and a vocalist, and my mom was also a vocalist. And interestingly enough, my dad is a Methodist minister and also spent 11 years in India. My whole family did as Methodist missionaries there. So there's that kind of medicine and music and spirituality crossover that I have enjoyed even from the time I was a little boy. And then also what's really interesting is that my grandfather was the head of RT French Company that makes French's mustard. So he became an expert in spices from India and China. And so I guess you could say it's just in the blood here in Rochester. I love herbs and spices. He used them in flavorings for food and things like that, and I use them medicinally, but they're some of the same spices that we have seen come over from India and China.
Well, your name, Tarji, where is that from? What is that originally from?
Yes. When I was in my 20s, I studied at a Tibetan Buddhist monastery in Woodstock, New York, called Karmatriyana Dharma Chakra. And when you study, I was there for about a year, year and a half, and you take initiation, you take kind of vows. I didn't take monk's vows at the time, but I was a serious Buddhist practitioner. And when you receive certain initiations, you also receive a name that signifies the initiation. And I just decided I loved my religious name so much, and I wasn't particularly attached to my birth name, so I changed it legally when I was in my 20s and have been Sonam now longer than I have been living as my birth name.
So, I see. Okay.
Story there, yeah.
So how did this learning, I'm fascinated by how this occurred. Did you go from one topic to another and that sort of led organically from one to another, or did you at one time, were you studying a bunch of different things that sort of interrelated with each other?
Yes. Well, there was a great Buddhist teacher named His Holiness the Karmapa, who I had the good fortune to meet in the 80s, early 80s, 81. And when I was at the monastery, he encouraged me to study medicine. And since my older sister is a nurse, and I had studied the biomedical model very much with anatomy, biology, kinesiology, and pharmacology, I had somewhat of a grasp at that when I was in high school. And then the Karmapa advised me to become a doctor. But I don't think he wanted me to become a doctor in the Western allopathic tradition. I had the feeling that when he gave me that piece of advice, that it was really for me to become a doctor in that Oriental medical tradition. So in 81, what was available for training was basically acupuncturist. And so the New England School of Acupuncture in Boston was a school that was close by, and I felt attracted to the Boston area. So I went there for my training, and I loved Chinese medicine. It was like the labyrinth of the electricity and the prana, the life energy moving through the body, and I was just fascinated. So I had a master's degree in Chinese medicine there from the New England School of Acupuncture in Boston. And then you use that word organically, because Chinese medicine and Ayurveda from India have so much in common, because the Silk Route was open and very flowing between the two countries for over many, many centuries. And sometimes the countries were isolationist, but for the most part, there was a lot of communication there. So I felt a very much of an organic progression from my training in Chinese medicine. And then I met my teacher, Dr. Vasant Ladd, who's from Pune, India, West India in 85, 86, and it just seemed to make even more sense to me than Chinese medicine did, if I could say that, because having been born in India and feeling very close at that point with the yogic tradition and studying pranayama and studying asanas and postures in the yogic tradition, I felt that I really needed to flesh out my understanding of the Asian medical tradition with both the Ayurvedic tradition from India and the Chinese tradition. So I started studying with Dr. Ladd. And Dr. Ladd really united the spiritual work with the medical work for me. I feel like he's my medical father in that way, you know. And so that was an organic step there. And then the process of studying Chinese medicine and Ayurveda together led me to Tibetan medicine, because since I was already a student of Tibetan Buddhism and training at the Tibetan Buddhist monastery, I felt drawn and attracted to studying Tibetan medicine. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama's personal physician at the time was named Dr. Yeshe Dundan, and he came to my school, and I also trained with him. So that kind of put that little piece of the puzzle together for me between the Chinese system and the Ayurvedic system in India.
Well, this is amazing. I mean, how wonderful to study with the Dalai Lama's physician. I mean, oh my golly, how exciting is that? But so during this time, you were pursuing this type of studies, and at the same time, you were branching out into different types of musical instruments?
Yes, it was a very interesting thing, because when I was young, I played trumpet. And in the city school district in Rochester, and when you enter fifth grade, you get a recorder.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of kids learn to play a simple plastic recorder. And I kind of liked the sound, so I started playing trumpet and recorder. And the recorder fingerings, I don't know if you know a little bit about flute technique, but once you play into the recorder, then many of those fingerings can be transferred onto silver flute or bamboo flute or quena from South America, or bansi, or what we call the bansuri flute of India. And so once I felt I had a basis in trumpet, which are the brasses, and the basis in the woodwinds, I could take off, and many, many instruments kind of came underneath my fingers very easily. And when I was growing up and listening to Indian music, I loved ragas, but I also loved Tchaikovsky and Bach and Beethoven. And so I got exposed to Indian music, and your ears kind of lead you. You know, what you love, you tend to want to play, and I played along with a lot of records. And so played along with Ravi Shankar records when I was little, and just loved the Indian music. So I started branching out from a recorder into the North Indian bamboo flutes.
And did you play with groups at that time, or?
You know, I had seven different ensembles. By the time I was a senior in high school, I was playing seven ensembles and had at least one rehearsal a night. So it's just been kind of like that. The music gives you energy. It doesn't take any energy. If you go to rehearsal after dinner in the evening, 7:30 to 9:30 or 8 to 10 or something like that, you leave feeling more refreshed and energized than you did before the rehearsal. So it gives energy in that way.
Mm. All right. Well, I'm going to go back to... I just have so many questions, but I'm going to try to keep myself on track here.
Okay.
I'm going to go back to the whole idea of the synthesis of the different type medicine traditions, the holistic medicine traditions.
Yeah.
And you said I also started with Yellow Emperor's Classic of Chinese Medicine and wended my way to Ayurvedic myself, not nearly at the depth that you have, but that sort of was my, and I could, because of the pressure points and the chakra system all being similar, and the acupuncture points very much in line with the Ayurvedic and the chakra system, it was an easy segue into that to learning about the Ayurvedic. But I found the Ayurvedic a little daunting in terms of, you know, the Pitta and the Vata and the and what I was and what I was supposed to eat, when I was supposed to eat it, and but you have talked about here that you blend what you call the three sisters of Vedic culture.
Yes.
Ayurveda.
You're good.
Tantra and yoga. So, and I did not do that. I did a little yoga here, and then I did a little, like that. Not together. Why is it so important to doing these three things together, and does it make more sense that way?
Yes, great question. Because, you know, many Westerners come to yoga first, and their understanding of yoga is postures and pranayama and the breathing techniques. And that's very good. It's a very excellent place to start in our culture that has so much emphasis on sometimes the physical first, then learning postures and gaining core strength and flexibility. This is very good. But if you say yoga to someone who's traditionally trained in India, what they think of first is karma yoga and bhakti yoga, which is devotional yoga and loving kindness yogas. They might think about Kundalini yoga and the use of the nadis, what we call nadis, which means the channels of the movement of the life force, prana. And they would think of yoga as more spiritual, God realization type of training. And so that they would go to an Ayurvedic practitioner for the body work and the understanding of disease process and how to get better and how to work with the body. And in the West now, it's kind of like switched. People go to see the yoga teacher for their physical body training, and they go to see the Ayurvedic practitioner oftentimes for their spiritual life and in addition to the medical work. And then the tantric work is very much like mind training. So we can use labyrinths as part of the mind training. We can use essential oils and aromatherapy as the mind training, all the various types of ritual work, mantras, visualization, these kinds of things. And so I don't think we should divorce them at all. It's really the three sisters of Vedic culture that grew out of ancient India kind of together as a unit that were never divorced before. So we have this opportunity now here in the West to bring them together again in our minds and hearts.
Hmm. And so you teach up in Rochester. How does that work? Does the student sign up for beginners 1, 2, 3, intermediate 1, 2, 3, advanced 1, 2, 3, like that, so that they learn consecutively these different practices together?
Yeah, good question. Because I've had a clinic for 27 years here now in Rochester, many of my patients kind of become interested in taking care of themselves. So then I might start out with a course that's just basically self-healing techniques, what to eat, some things to avoid, and what herbs and spices benefit digestion. And then, you know, if a cough or a cold comes up, how to adjust your diet and simple, generally regarded as safe herbal medicines to take care of oneself. And then we can start to branch out and learn how to touch some points, which are called marmas in the Ayurvedic tradition, or, you know, there are many correspondences between the Chinese medical points and the Ayurvedic understanding of marmas. So my students will learn some marmas in addition to the herbal medicine, and then they'll learn a breathing technique, and they'll learn a prayer, and they'll learn a posture, maybe even all in the same class, because then it doesn't compartmentalize them in a conscious way or in an unconscious way. That's how we train here in Rochester.
Okay, that sounds. It sounds though that the first thing that they want to take care of is their physical well-being, and that you attend to that first. That they come to you for that, and then once they get to the point where they don't have a million ailments that are causing them upset and dis-ease, they can then branch into the spiritual and the ritual realms more. I see.
That's
I think
right.
That's what you're.
Some people definitely come to it from that purely, geez, I just have a symptom and I would dearly love to get rid of this symptom. And some people come to it maybe with a symptom, but already saying, oh, the symptom is a messenger. It's a symbol for something that I want to resolve in my unconscious process or understand the karmas of the symptom. So they want to work on themselves immediately in terms of emotional maturity and spiritual maturity, and they wed that with their herbal work and the dietary work and the exercise pattern, and that makes a very powerful healing force in their life.
So you see people in a group as well as individually?
Well, sometimes I see families in the same room together. Inside a class, we might take a case history and have someone willing to share their health history and pulses and look at their tongue, and all the people in the class would observe. And that way, probably a more advanced student would then be able to look at the tongue and observe the tongue for its diagnostic information and feel the pulse at the radial artery at the wrist for some diagnostic information there, and then, as it were, sit in on the consultation so they could learn by just listening to me ask the appropriate questions and then putting all those pieces of the puzzle together to determine the pattern and then what herbal medicines and dietary work antidote that pattern.
Okay, well, you mentioned a little bit ago, you referenced the labyrinth in terms of the tantric focusing the mind, and so tell me a little bit. I was not at the 2008 gathering, but you did play at the 2008. You were the featured musician there for on Saturday night.
Yes.
How did you come to and be involved with Labyrinth and with the TLS, with the Labyrinth Society?
Well, I think it's important to use many different tools with which to grow spiritually. So when I was young, inside the Christian training, that there are labyrinths, and for instance, the floor of the Chartres Cathedral in France is the most well-known labyrinth that is kind of part of that Catholic and Christian tradition. And then when I was in India, I also noted that all the temples and religious sites were set out in a certain sacred geometrical shapes and patterns. And then the same thing with a Chinese pagoda, how it observes the principles of the mathematical sacred geometry. So when the labyrinth quest was established here by a wonderful labyrinth practitioner named Harriet Royer. Harriet wanted to make the monthly labyrinth gatherings here in a sacred space inside a church. She wanted to make it replete with music and with healers. So now, once a month, on a given Monday, people will come to the Unitarian Church here on Winton Road, and they'll listen to me play the sacred music while they walk the labyrinth, and then after their walking experience, they might lie down on a table in the same room and have a Reiki treatment or a craniosacral treatment or a Qigong treatment. It's really quite a unique venue that we have going in Rochester, and it's all free. People can come on, you know, one month and not come on the next month, or come early or stay later, leave early, and it's a very kind of free but well-attended labyrinth walk.
And is the labyrinth a canvas labyrinth, or is it, inlaid?
There's a canvas labyrinth that we lay out that takes up most of the sanctuary, and then there's also an outdoor labyrinth that we use during the nice warm weather in the spring and summer. And the canvas labyrinth is about two-thirds or three-quarters size from the Chartres Cathedral Labyrinth. So it's quite a large one and can accommodate maybe 30, 40 walkers all at the same time.
And so for the was through Harriet that you got involved with the TLF gathering in 2008? And
yes, she has been an inspiration to me because she said, you know, there's that correspondence between the harmonics inside the labyrinth of the various levels of the labyrinth going into the center and then coming back out again. And of course there are the harmonics of the various progressions of doubling and tripling and quadrupling the vibratory rates in music. So someone who is subtle and sensitive and aware of the harmonics, which are the notes that are not played, but like the shadings and to use an analogy, it's almost like the angelic voices that are in the spaces above human hearing that we can start to become sensitive to, then they play off each other well, the labyrinth walking and the music both at the same time.
So for the gathering, so I'm assuming that just like walking the labyrinth is different every time. When you play for a labyrinth event or for ritual, do you have a set idea of what musical instruments you're going to play, or do you just bring a bunch of different ones and you just sort of feed off of the vibration of the people there and what is taking place there? How do you prepare?
It's very nice because I lay out, 20 or 30 instruments that I might want to have available. And then oftentimes I'll start with the Native American love flute because here in Rochester, New York, we have good Seneca tradition. I feel like I want to honor the earth where we are, and the labyrinth is very much at first an earth element experience because we are walking on the sacred earth. So the Native American and Seneca and Onondaga love flute is quite a great way to start. And then oftentimes when in modern America we're seeing a synthesis of religious and spiritual traditions, so because there's been so much bad press about Islam and many fundamentalists making a bad name for a glorious tradition of Islam and Sufic traditions, I'll play the Sufi flutes and play them in a way that is unmistakably Arabic and but yet dedicated to discernment of spiritual truth, so that when someone is walking the labyrinth, they realize that this is in an unconscious as well as conscious level, that this is a universal experience that has no boundary between Islam and Christianity and Judaic tradition, Buddhist, Hindu, Taoist traditions, etc. And that's very good for all of us to really put that together in a deeper way. So that's why I might choose the Arabic flute called Ney, N-E-Y, which is the Sufi flute, or I might play one of the other end-blown flutes from that Turkish and Balkan region called a kaval, K-A-V-A-L.
And then you also play percussion as well.
Yes, I feel very lucky in my life that because I was born in India, we have so many friends still back in India, that I flew to India when I was 19, and I studied percussion, which means tabla, which are the two small Indian drums that accompanied Ravi Shankar. And Ravi Shankar, of course, was George Harrison of the Beatles. He was his sitar teacher. And the other drum that's common in the South Indian tradition is called mridangam, M-R-I-D-A-N-G-A-M, as in Mary at the end. Mridangam is a barrel drum, and you play both sides of it. It has a treble side and a bass side. So that when I was studying in North India and South India, I studied both tabla and mridangam. And when I came back to the States, I had a friend who was playing in a Turkish band, and he said, "Oh, Sonam, you can play the Turkish drums. If you play Indian drums, you can play Turkish drums." And of course, it's an incredibly far stretch from tabla technique to dumbek, but I felt inspired to play with this Turkish and belly dance ensemble actually for many years. And I got Dumbek lessons from one of the saz and balama players in the ensemble. And so I feel very much love for this Arabic tradition as well as for the Indian tradition. I feel like I'm kind of go both ways that way.
And do you switch off so you're I'd like to we have a caller by the way. So
perfect.
In the next minute or two, we'll bring this person in.
Very good.
But I just wanted to get a sense of do you sort of go into trance when you're playing at the labyrinth? But you have to stay aware, just like you do, you know, when you're doing ritual or ceremony. But how do you just sense when to change from one flute to another? Do you invite other people to play with you? How does that all work?
Well, I try and stay as aware as possible, not like in a trance work, but maybe we could call it an altered state of consciousness, but in some ways an aware work of how the walkers are walking. Is it fast? Is it slow? And just stay in tune with maybe now is a good time for a percussive one, because then that would complement this one's, one or two persons really almost dancing inside the labyrinth. And sometimes we'll have a very quiet evening where I won't play much percussion at all. It'll be mostly voice and solo flute and those kinds of things. So I don't have a really good answer for you, because it's so intuitive and, ephemeral that way.
So you do, though, use your voice as well as playing instruments. Do you chant or you hum, or is it a specific chant that you do, or do you mix like a Sufi flute with a Native American chant?
Yes, often not in the same piece, but there's this wonderful kirtan. Kirtan is a Sanskrit word that means praising. So a kirtan tradition that's generally accompanied by harmonium, which is like the little keyboard squeeze box that the Indian people received from England and took it as a ritual instrument for themselves. And so I play some harmonium and sing traditional chants like Govinda Jaya Jaya Gopala Jaya Jaya Govinda Jaya Gopala Jaya Jaya, and those kinds of things that are honoring Krishna or honoring Radha in that those deep archetypal prayers that are so meaningful to us.
It must be a wonderful experience, and I did speak to Harriet, and she said that it was just magical having you play next to everybody walking at the 2008 gathering. Sounds wonderful, and I hope you will be persuaded to come and play again for a gathering in the future. But I just wanted to plug some things before we get this person on. She's been waiting very patiently, he or she.
Yeah.
You have an event schedule. Your website is www.aumhealing.com, AUMHEALING.com.
Yes.
You've got a Lara Labyrinth event scheduled for the coming months.
Yes.
You have an evening service at Assisi Institute. What is that about?
Well, as you may know, when Paramahansa Yogananda came to this country under the direction of his guru, Sri Yukteswar, and when he kind of brought yoga to the West, he brought what we call Kriya Yoga. And Yogananda also had a dear love for Jesus Christ, and he had an affinity with St. Francis of Assisi. So hence the name, the Assisi Institute, and it's a blending of the yogic tradition as seen through the eyes of Paramahansa Yogananda and the Christian tradition. So I feel very much at home there, as you can imagine, now knowing what I love to do. And so sometimes we would sing a Christian chant and a Hindu chant, both in the same service, and the sacred words like Alleluia and the sacred word like Hare Krishna are, we wed them together in the same musical piece. And it's lovely to chant that that with the Assisi Institute people.
And that is, how long is the service?
The service is an hour and a half, and it's quite remarkable because there's some quiet sitting, there's some prayers, there's some Dharma discussion, as it were, you know, talking about one point, and we'll pick a focal point, like just constancy or prayer or something like that, and we'll look at what Yogananda might have to say about it, and then we'll look at what St. Francis had to say about it, and it's quite a divine interplay there.
Mm. And you have First Friday Chants at the Natural Oasis Market and Wellness Center. Do you teach chanting for this event, and is there a specific type? Or?
Well, we are pretty eclectic, so we are emphasizing the Shivite tradition, the Shiva chants in the Indian tradition, or the Vishnavite, which are more Krishna-based chanting, but we also chant Om Mani Padme Hum, which is the traditional Tibetan chant, or Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha, which is also a traditional goddess chant in the Tibetan tradition. And between 20, 30, 40 people come, and we offer it as a gift, and people leave little donations. And so it's wonderful, kind of shifting crowd of people that come. And the singing is just lovely, just lovely. I don't teach it so much on those evenings because people just want to come and chant and have the experience. But at some point, I want to teach more formally what we call nada yoga, which is the yoga of sound. And looking forward to doing that very much more at the Natural Oasis Market and Wellness Center here.
Well, okay, let's get this poor person who's been so patiently waiting. Let's get
this
person on the phone right now.
Wonderful.
Hello. This is this is Christiana. Can I ask your name, please, and where you're from?
Yes, my name is Suda, and I'm from Rochester, New York.
And welcome, namaste.
Really, thank you, and I'm really enjoying the show tonight.
Mm, wonderful.
So my question is, can I go ahead with the question?
Go right ahead.
All righty. I'm really interested in the healing arts. And I love the way that Sonam combines them with spiritual work as well. And what I'm wondering is, I'm thinking about starting studying the healing arts, and I'm wondering where is a good place to start in terms of building up. I know you spoke about a lot of things tonight, but if I wanted to begin a study and just carry it through a number of years and eventually use it as a practice, where would I start?
Well, there are many profoundly wise and wonderful teachers of many different medical traditions now that we have the luxury of having here in the West. So my teacher, Dr. Vasant Ladd, owns and runs the Ayurvedic Institute in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And short of, you know, moving to Albuquerque, kit and caboodle for a couple of years and studying with Dr. Ladd, there are all of Dr. Ladd's wonderful books. So best thing is to just go to Albuquerque and be in the Gurukulam, what we call be in the divine grace of such a profound teacher as Dr. Ladd. And then for someone who's very much drawn to the Taoist tradition and maybe the very much more Far Eastern tradition of Buddhism and Zen tradition in Japan, they might want to go study actually in Vancouver at one of the great Oriental medical colleges in Vancouver, where you are, Christiana. And also there is a terrific, the Austin Institute of Oriental Medicine in Austin, Texas is just a wonderful and profound place that weds the Taoist understanding of healing arts and martial arts with acupuncture and herbal medicine. And so those are some, you know, suggestions about places to study and ways to integrate it into your life there?
So those places, they combine the natural healing methods with the spiritual element?
Yes, I think very much so. Both of those, all three of those places would be doing that. And then it kind of depends on leanings that you may have in terms of what spiritual path that you are already on, and then how to conjoin that with a practice of medicine and maybe even a martial arts practice or a movement practice that would also dovetail nicely with your spiritual practice.
That sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
I studied with Montauk Chia in Qigong at Dow Mountain, which is not too far from you up near Woodstock. For many years, went to Dow Mountain to their summer residency programs. I studied for a couple of years there, as well as practiced and studied at their in their center in New York City. And I studied their Qigong form, as well as their different levels of healing, and also Qine Chang, which is the medicinal manipulation of the intestinal area. So there's also that, and he's wonderful. Montauk Chia's work is wonderful.
I love Master Chia's work, and when he first came to this country from Thailand, we had many classes with him in Boston, and since I was at the New England School of Acupuncture right there, I felt very blessed to have known Master Chia as well, Christiana. Mm-hmm. And it's so lovely to contrast the inner heavenly orbit work, or what Master Chia calls the microcosmic orbit work, with the understanding of the governing vessel, what we call the Dumo and the Renmo of the Chinese medical understanding, with his understanding of the orbit there, and also to contrast that with the traditional Kundalini Shakti understanding of the Sushumna being the central channel and the Ida and the Pingala as being the two corollary channels that are on the right and left that cross at each chakra point. And some traditions, for instance, Tibetan medical tradition, very much they all three ascend together and only come together at the Triveni point in the brow chakra. So it's just fascinating to study the relationship between the energy body understanding of each of these traditions. It's very revealing.
Yeah, I think for me, what I did, because I studied macrobiotics when I was in my 20s and then went from there to Chinese medicine and et cetera, it was what called to me at that time and what resonated with me at that time of my life.
Yeah.
And then that would just sort of evolve into another path. So I think for my suggestion to you is to you know, go to one of each of these classes and just what resonates to you, what stirs your heart, what calls to you. You'll know which one of them is right for you at this time.
Good answer. That's really a profound answer. Excellent.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Mm-hmm. So, Christina, we're winding up our time here. Do you have any other questions for me?
I think that, we are out of time. We only have a couple of minutes left. But, I could go on, and I would love to talk to you some more.
It's been a joy to talk with you.
Especially about the music, because I play the hammered dulcimer, and I'm using that, studying it now to use it to accompany my labyrinth walks. And I hope that you will come to more of the gatherings and that we will meet again sometime soon. But thank you so much for joining me today.
You're most welcome. I would love to hear you play the hammered dulcimer, and I'm sure you're aware of the cimbalom tradition and the santur tradition of Northern
India.
And that. And so there's so much cross-cultural territory in there for you to explore with the hammered dulcimer and various tunings, and that will be a perfect instrument for accompanying labyrinth walks.
Yes, I think so too. I have a very resonant one, and all I have to do is just play one note here and there, and it just, you know, fills the space. It's very nice. It's very nice.
Oh.
Well, thank you, Sonam. Thank you so much, and many blessings on your path, and have a wonderful year this year, and hopefully we'll see you soon.
Yes, I very much love that, and blessings on your path as well. A joy to meet you, Christiana.
Thank you.
All righty.
You've been listening to Labyrinth in the News in the live category on blogtalkradio.com with your host, Christiana. Please join me next week when my guest will be Cordelia Rose, the owner of White Mesa Labyrinth in southwest New Mexico, where she teaches yoga and holds labyrinth events for humans and horses. Join us as we discuss the subject of equine labyrinths and where this topic has led her. This episode will air at 1 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time on the 18th, so please take note of that. Have a blessed week, and in Lakesh.